coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, woof, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. This is issue 209.
Hey, hey.
That's
hey, 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 hey. Oh, I'm sorry. Go on. I thought you were either going to continue. This was just going to be the, instead of interacting, I was just going to go hi, hi. The entire show, because it seemed like a good idea.
It sounded like what was going to happen was a weird sampled like house music, like Blade style beat was going to drop under you, and then I was going to kill vampires, which is what I spent our entire Christmas break doing, by the way. I spent it eradicating vampires. That's a little known problem. Little known fact is that vampires come out en masse around Christmas, and somebody has to take care of them. So we took a break. My break was spent killing vampires. Cole, what was your break spent doing?
I actually, via a friend of mine, known as the Mighty Placeholder, this year sporting his winter coat, went out and joined Spider-Man himself in Dallas, handing out gifts for the kids.
Yeah, way to high-road me. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate that. I did was kill a bunch of vampires. You did a bunch of charitable work. God.
I think killing vampires is charitable because there's a lot of monetizing in the vampire killing business nowadays.
There is.
It's kind of lost the spirit. I say bring the killing back to vampire killing.
And it got real commercial.
It's not like vampire killing, hey, we're going to make a killing at this. No, the idea is to get out there and just kill those vampires for the good of mankind.
I mean, what I offer is gluten-free, farm-to-table, pedigreed vampire killing. You know, I do it for the joy of it. You know, I don't need to worry about, you know, the margins. I just get out there and kill some vampires. But as impractical as that sounds, tonight we're going to talk about a whole lot more impractical things than just me at 150 pounds at 40 years old killing vampires.
Well, I mean, not all vampires are vital.
A lot of memoir by Cole Houston.
Yeah, they're some of them were turned when they were spastic or lazy or really, really old. I mean, people imagine that just because you're a vampire, you must look a certain way. And I think there's a lot of vamp shaming out there.
Wait, hold on. Can we back up to the fact that apparently you were turned in 1918 when spastic was a thing you could be?
Yeah, well, that's the thing about semi-immortality.
how are the vampire's humors? They were spastic.
That's right. Well, you know, their gray humors were a little off, so nothing a good...
That's awesome. Oh, my God. So what are we talking about tonight?
We are talking about, as the title indicates, the Impracticals. Now, the Impracticals is not... one of those like dollar store ripoff DVDs you find every time a Disney movie comes out. Island Girl or whatever the you know, whatever the corollary to Disney's latest hit is, there's bound to be something like that out there. And somebody whose grandma got him Island Girl for Christmas is laughing hysterically right now, like, you do exactly what we're talking about here. But because they're now getting to the point where they've run out of mythical characters, so now they have to, like, make up their own mythology.
Right, because nothing is... It's not like these characters are open source or, you know, able
to be... Yeah, exactly. Because we've run out of Hans Christian public domain, and so now people can't rip them off as easily.
That was my favorite... That was my favorite Bill Willingham side work, was Hans Christian Open Domain.
Yeah, Hans Christian Public Domain was published actually by First Comics, and it ran three issues. It turns out they got sued by the estate of Rumpelstiltskin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it turns out that was not public domain. There actually was a Rumpelstiltskin. Who lent his name. It's kind of like, you know, Benjamin Franklin Plumbing or you know, John Hancock Furniture. They, yes. Or the, whatever the hell college was named after.
Two real people. Okay, continue. Yeah,
who sold the rights to their name.
I love the fact that we're doing a show on impracticality in comics, and our entire shtick is being impractical in comics. That's what we do.
So let's... This was an issue that literally was partially inspired by preparations for the last issue.
Okay.
And therefore, subsequently got bumped the hell up the schedule ladder.
As they do. We do that. If we have an idea we want to run with, you get it, you know, Katie bar the door and man the, you know, damn the torpedoes, we're doing it. We're doing the damn thing. So yeah, I mean, and in Cole's defense, this idea that spun out of research for a, you know, a prior show, the more I thought about it over the holiday, the more it became genius in my brain. Because for me, the entire idea of comic books, and I think one of the reasons that I've loved comic books for as long as I have, one of the, you know, myriad reasons, is that it is anchored. Comic books, comic book characters, comic book writing, comic book creation. You know, the idea that comic books exist at all as a medium is wholly and completely impractical. Like from top down, from inception to creation to hitting the shelves to you buying it to you reading it and enjoying it is an exercise in impracticality. It's amazing to me that we still have comic books that we can go buy and read, because we're talking about a 28 page serialized episodic adventure, some of which has source material going back what, 60 years, 70 years now, 75, yeah. 80 years, and yet still viable in its most impractical form, which is not, you know, I'm going to, you know, buy a book in a series and read it, and maybe there'll be like a George R. R. Martin where there's one book every couple years or every 100 years, depending on if it's his last book or not. But this is every month. And we wonder, we sit around and wonder about why they have to reboot the universes every 10 years, because there's no way to practically keep the continuity together for that long. It's amazing. Well,
certainly, I think that also, and this speaks very much to the impracticality issue that is the crux of this issue, is that over time, you are going to... I think, you know, by the time they got somebody seriously researching the DC universe, which led to the crisis, you know, which was to develop the source material for the Crisis on Infinite Earths, the deeper they dug, the more they began to realize, you know what? There's stuff here we don't want anyone to ever find, and decide, hey, let's make this part of a story. Let's find a way to bring back Superman being able to will miniature duplicates of himself out of thin air. Because that was a bad idea when it was published. It does not need further exploration. So let's just say it never happened.
Right. Let's just wipe the map clean and start over every 25 years because it's necessary. So what about for you, Cole? Where does this start? Where do the impractical start for you?
Well, you know, that's kind of a loaded question, because the core concept came out of talking about pretty much anybody seafaring in superherodom, from, you know, talking about how having fully developed pairs of wings on both ankles, having your wings in pairs, means your interior wings are constantly flapping into each other, suggesting that they have nothing to do with your flight, or you have to just sort of develop this curious legs akimbo.
Right, a wide gait.
You just really have to pretend like you're riding a horse or something while you're flying.
That is the most beautiful mental image, by the way. If everybody could stop and kind of go into themselves, go to that place that they go to, and just imagine Namor flying, but just straight up sea legs, like you said, legs akimbo, just wide stance, just flying through the air. Because when we think about superheroes flying, their legs together, arm up in the air, Superman, Iron Man style, but yeah, not Namor.
There is really no practical corollary to the stance you'd have to achieve, other than just to say, okay, invisible Gillies Bull.
Right.
Because that's what people are thinking. What is this, like a mime? This is like Urban Cowboy. What's that other movie? You know, they think you're like trying to do some kind of pantomimes or whatever the hell that game is that suddenly the name of which escapes me at the moment.
Charades,
yes. So.
Sorry, Namor's not the only one getting back on that horse. We've had a long break.
Yes, we are back from our hiatus, as you may have guessed. But, you know, that, Stingray, you know, you've got the Incredibles, their costume designer who has just a serious nut against capes. Underwater capes are even worse idea than terrestrial capes.
They really are.
That's just, there is no good way to move around with a bed sheet wrapped around you if you're underwater.
I think, you know, you're absolutely right. Like the
especially a waterproof one.
Anything underwater is ridiculous. Anything they put together and try to get you to believe that practically this is going to work, it can't work. The only thing I can figure is that, like, Namor would have to have some sort of, like, Aquaman seahorse that he uses as a prop just so he doesn't look so ridiculous when he's flying. Like, just something
between
his legs.
Yeah, but then he would
just
have to be, like, constantly gripping that poor animal.
Well, sure.
Between his hips, you know? It's just this perpetual sort of really awkward spooning kind of thing. And then, you know, add to that, we talked extensively about both Namor and Aquaman, both being princes of Atlantis. And one of the accoutrements thereof is, of course, a trident.
Giant-ass trident, yes.
In some cases, like, Namor's got one that's like the super elaborate, you know, when we have company over trident.
Get out the fancy trident.
Yeah. The fancy one. And, you know, with due deference to the ancient world and the ever-popular gladiatorial fixture, the Mermalo, tridents are not a really effective weapon, you know, the giant economy-sized gigging fork. It does not glide effortlessly at your side through the water. It's difficult enough to have one of those James Bond spear guns going on.
Right. To not get the giant ass trident you're dragging, you know, the drag coefficient. I don't know what the drag coefficient is on a giant ass trident, but not getting it caught in between your inside ankle wings while you're trying to fly swim is a sentence, first of all, that I never thought I would ever utter in my entire life. Secondly, has to be difficult. It can't be easy to do that. But no, you're right. The ocean. I didn't realize that that's where this had spawned from. But holy hell! Speaking of impracticality, that's crazy.
There's nothing in the entire catalog of characters that isn't impractical.
No,
I think the closest you get is the kind of Woodstock cosplay of Dolphin.
Which go on.
She didn't get much coverage in the last show, so I wanted to point out that, you know, Dolphin went around in hot pants and a halter top.
Well, I mean, it was very, very...
Undersea hot pants and halter top.
It was very incense and peppermints during that time period anyway, so why not? You know, but that's the other thing. You get the attempt at practicality, right? I don't know where they go off the rails, like in the bullpen, but you get the attempt at practicality. For instance, Namor. Okay, so we got this guy. He's a swimmer. So let's go look at some swimmers. Like, let's draw from the source material of swimmers. Okay, so we're going to look at these pictures when we're creating him. Okay, Speedo, generally what is being worn, let's say, in the Olympics at the time period for swimming.
I have to, though, give them that they did sort of predict, probably less so with Namor, but to some degree there, and heavily certainly with Aquaman, that kind of... Olympic swimwear that's based on shark skin.
Right.
Except apparently the stylish version is kind of goldfish skin.
It's carp.
Carp skin, yes, indeed.
Carp skin. But
it's the sort of thing you wear when you want to be coy.
damn it. That's our show, ladies and gentlemen. thanks for joining. No, but then they're like, okay, so we got that. He's got the Speedo. That's, you know, the whoever was the Olympic swimmer at the time. Like, we're looking at pictures, we're getting those ideas. Okay, we got that. That's great. You know, we really don't, the Fantastic Four, very basic costumes with the exception of the Thing, and we know why, because Kirby had an idea. But everybody else, that we're going to keep it real low, we're going to keep it low profile, we're going to simplify. Why are there wings on Jack? Why are there wings on his ankles? Well, I thought, you know,
just imagine that Kirby just look it up real quick. There's wings on the ankles, yes.
Yes. Yeah, I'm coming. Big giant trident, check. Like, no, that defeats the purpose. We had it. You went too far. Like, this is not necessary. Only later to be outdone by the impracticality of ankle pouches, the next evolution in impractical ankles.
I had not thought about that.
The Rob Liefeld ankle pouches.
Because, you know, when you, if Batman taught us anything, having a lot of equipment at your disposal at will is a great idea for crime fighters. But when you have to find a park bench, you can sit down and root around at your ankles.
Right.
Or you have to TiVo or Tebow or what, T-Bone, whatever.
There's a reference from like 4 years ago. We're going to talk about T-Bowing tonight.
I'm usually on a delayed reaction.
That was good. I liked that one. No, but you know what's sad? You bring up Batman, as we often do. I'm almost willing to go out on a limb here. And with the obvious exceptions of wearing a giant bat costume, which I think just comes down to necessity, right? I think at that point, everybody else is wearing the new football helmet, so you have to wear the new football helmet. I think outside of that, Batman might be one of the most, and this is going to, I can't believe I'm saying this out loud, might be one of the most practical superheroes out there. I'm saying it. I know.
I think that's, is he practical by nature or practical by necessity? Because he pretty much has to be practical by necessity, because there are any number of things he has to compensate for a lack thereof.
Correct. I agree. And that's why, I think that's why, so we're always trying to use Batman as the Rosetta Stone for everything on this show, because I think in a lot of ways he is. But I think that we relate to Batman as comic book readers because he has to be practical. He's the only one that has to be practical. And it's comic book practical, so it's not like our practical. He doesn't go out.
He doesn't necessarily have to work.
Right. He doesn't go out and buy the car with the best gas mileage. You know, he isn't considering the commute. But when you're living a world with Superman and Wonder Woman and, you know, Aquaman, you have to be practical within the rules, the rule set of your universe. And I think having like Batman shark repellent and boomerangs in the shape of your logo, you know, and your branding, I think those are, make him maybe the most practical superhero. That seems like it's hard to say. I have to force it out of my body. But I think that that's true. How do you feel about that? Because I was thinking about that.
I think that what we've done is sort of inadvertently established Batman is your baseline, and everybody else that we're going to talk about falls below or drastically below or down into the Stygian depths of below where Batman is on this scale of practicality, of comic book practicality, if you will. I'm reminded of a character, and I searched a lot today to try to find, I thought that it was a character or group of characters that met their end at the hands or the gun of none other than the Scourge of the Underworld.
Sure.
I thought that's where I came across them. Apparently it wasn't. But it was a Hulk villain, or villains to be more precise, that were... It was like this sort of Voltron school of exoskeletal armor.
Okay.
Only on a smaller scale robot, you know, maybe a robot about 9 or 10 feet tall, that was made up of a bunch of Priuses that had been remolded into robot arms and legs and torso.
No, are you serious?
Well, I mean, they weren't really Priuses, but those sections would be about the size of a Prius.
Okay.
If you beat it into the shape of arms and legs. Or if you beat several of them.
That's awesome. There was one you sent me that I thought was on the nose, but then it became more relevant today when I was reading things. I saw a funny one of them funny internet pictures of somebody taking this item, because there was an announcement today that Amazon is researching, or at least has put in a patent of some sort to do airborne warehouses. And I saw a picture of the Shield helicarrier painted up with all the Amazon logos on it. Like, first picture of Amazon's sky warehouse. And I was like, God, that's perfect. That's exactly true.
Because as we all know, what goes up just tends to stay there.
Well, sure, of course, especially in the comic books, right? So why did you send me the Shield helicarrier? It seems perfectly practical to me.
Oh, yeah, well, there you have it. I think perhaps I was inspired by the potential that Amazon would go completely nuts and suggest using the thing as a warehouse. Because the thing about it is, two things about the upper atmosphere.
Right.
Number one, low-cost real estate.
Sure, nobody owns it.
It is literally like a land rush. An air rush, if you will. An air rush. And number two, unlike things like eminent domain and other shifty tricks here on Earth, apparently from what I have seen, I don't know a lot about this, they can't take the sky away from you.
It sounds like a John Denver song.
Oh, I never thought about that. I think it's a Firefly thing.
It could be.
So I just feel I had no really good solid concept, but I'm pretty sure it's Firefly.
I could see that being a Firefly.
Or Serenity or whatever the hell. I don't know which one's which even.
I think you were right. It was Firefly and then Serenity. So you landed correctly on that one. So, I don't know. I love this idea. I love the fact that I cannot think of a single comic book character. And I beg of you to challenge me. I would love for you to challenge me, because I've been going through the rosters in my brain to think of one single comic book character who doesn't function within the realm of impracticality. I can't think of one. Every one of them.
Oh no, there's plenty. Some of them get away with it by the very nature of their origins. And by that I mean that characters like let me think here. Thor, Hercules get away with any impracticalities because they're not of this earth.
Okay, so you can wipe the slate kind of clean at that point. Okay, I like that. I'm with that. So if you're Thor, if you're Hercules, you get away with it. You get grandfathered in.
Exactly, because you can't really be held to earthly standards.
All right, so alien characters, how do we feel about those guys? Like Martian Manhunter, probably the most impractical practical weapon ever to be invented. You know, the impractical Swiss Army knife of comic book characters. Do we give him a pass because he is Martian?
Not so much, because it's I don't know. It's hard to say, because he may get in on the what is known as the Superman clause.
Oh no, what's the Superman clause?
Which clause with a K for kryptonite?
Superman clause.
And that is that if you are too powerful, you have to the bylaws say you have to have some really impractical kind of weakness.
Oh, I like this.
Like,
okay.
Like yellow or bits and pieces of your former home world that are somehow counteract every single effect that makes you who you are by being here. And
which begs the question, by the way, and I don't think we've ever, since we're talking about impracticality, does that mean that, is that, so there's been lots of talk about why, you know, so Superman isn't special. He's not like a, you know, it's not like he has a meta gene on top of being Superman. He's just Superman,
yeah.
Right? Came from Krypton, has these powers because he's an alien.
Yeah, or because he is specifically a Red Sun alien. He comes from a world that his specific physiology, as the Daxamites would later teach us, renders him remarkably, perfectly suited to having the powers he has by virtue of being on a yellow sun planet versus a red sun planet. I don't think anybody checked to see if maybe the gravitational pull was a little different.
Right.
The atmosphere. There are probably other factors involved, but it's just easier to say, yeah, it's all about the sun. But the thing that is, you know, on a red, under red sun conditions, or certainly under Kryptonian conditions, he's just a guy, pretty ripped. You know, he'd probably be doing like some of those exercise commercials, like Chuck Norris. You know, like, yeah, me and my wife have been using this thing for 20 years, and it looks brand new.
He's the Jack LaLanne of Krypton. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. He would be like, you know, back on Krypton, he'd probably gone into action hero winging on film or something.
So what does the planet being chock-a-block on the inside with Krypton do to Kryptonians in normal time? Like, obviously, it's not...
You have to ask, was it really even the red sun conditions? Or I mean, does it, even like a yes. tiny, like a chip, just yeah. a little sliver, you know, like the kind of stuff people go out in the Diamond District and gouge out of the concrete...
Right.
And, you know, even that's enough to kind of give him the pukes. It begs the question, were the Kryptonians, I mean, what do we really know about them? Was their life span that long? You know, maybe they were just like dying by inches.
But like,
because that's a pretty powerful planet core.
Well, yeah, when your planet is full of Krypton the way that Shelley Winters is full of biscuits, you have to wonder, was that stunting their natural? Like, what if Flint, you know, the geographic Flint, the rock Flint, what if it had the same thing for us? If we got rid of all the Flint on the planet, what if we could fly?
Okay, I was afraid for a moment there you were talking about Flint, the warrant officer of G.I. Joe, who carries the shotgun.
No, I
really
would never.
See, I mean, the guns, for, you know, that makes this his party, but...
I would never talk about getting rid of Flint. I'd have to answer to Eddie
goodness.
Medina.
But yeah, like you say, is there something about why is it that it's that counterproductive? My personal theory is that kryptonite is not Kryptonian in nature.
Okay.
And I think it would be fun if somebody did something like, you know, posit that none of the kryptonite ever came from how explosive was Krypton that it could send tiny shards of itself. And, by the way, a spherical object like that getting blowed up pretty much shoots shards in every direction.
Right.
Which means the really ambitious amongst us can go out and harvest kryptonite for tens of thousands of centuries and still have plenty left over for, you know, next year.
And how can Superman go anywhere in the cosmos without
yeah,
encountering kryptonite?
There are places you would go. It's like the JLA, like, hey, we got to go fight some Mongol or something. It's like, oh, I can't go in these 27 districts that are all adjacent to 150 billion other places I can't go.
It makes him the weakest, most impractical. Kryptonite...
You think it's annoying to have a house full of cats and that one friend who's hyper allergic?
Kryptonite makes Superman, I think we've just landed on the fact that kryptonite makes Superman the most impractical comic book character.
That's odd, because that's that whole Batman versus Superman thing. He is now, like, on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Do you bleed? Yeah, I do. A lot. Everywhere. There's kryptonite everywhere. It's atomized. It's in space dust. It's in my lungs right now. I'm like an asthmatic. Does anybody have an inhaler? I can't be here right now. I don't know how
I'm
flying.
All of a sudden, I feel like I need somebody to come to Superman's defense, you know? It's like, are you having trouble because your planet blew up before you were, right after you were born? I will sue your planet.
It's like those mesothelioma commercials.
Exactly.
Oh my god. All right, I gotta ask.
Let's get into some really
yeah.
super impractical characters.
Come on.
Because, you know, like I said, this really, it goes back to its origins are in the water.
Like all
with
things.
The giant fin on a tiger shark's costume.
Why? Why is that there? It is the most ill-placed fin I've ever seen on a...
It would make it very difficult to ever right yourself to get back, you know.
Right.
You pretty much just have to crawl out of the ocean every time. Like, can you kids there just give me a hand?
can you push? Give me a little push. Can you give old Uncle Tiger Shark a push out of the water?
That's right. I promise I won't kill you. But that, you know, they got me thinking, there was that Hulk character that was a quintet of evil geniuses, and each one was controlling, I guess, a different aspect of this big robot thing they were driving around in to fight the Hulk. And somebody please tell me what the hell that character was, because I stumbled on it. I thought, this is the most ridiculous. And now I can't find it a couple of years later. So that's what I get for not writing stuff down, I guess. But, you know, the impracticality there is that, you know, either you just everybody, you know, each of you either are just have such a big ego that everybody had to be a part of this. Or you have to count on the utmost cooperation between five different brains working five different components of the same robot.
Right, which is...
You think that, remember that Group X-Men video game? I think it's hard to coordinate that. It's like, come on, kick Hulk! I'm trying to, but your leg down for my leg to go up or the whole thing falls over.
Right. Can you imagine throwing... I would love to have, like, Bobby Blakey on to explain how you would have to throw a punch if everybody was controlling a different limb or torso or head.
There's no muscle memory there. It's just this constant, this cacophony of jabber.
Right. Like, this foot has to be positioned out front. This foot needs to be positioned in the back. The torso needs to turn, you know, this much torque needs to go into the torso turning. This arm needs to be in this position, and then the right arm needs to follow through with the punch while the torso turns. The feet switch. The head needs to, you know, turn this way. They would never get anything done. You would never get anything done. Yes, you are absolutely correct. What about, I need to ask this question because, you know, we always come back to this. Talk to me about the practicality of the Watchmen, because I feel like Alan Moore does a very good job of instilling practicality in all of the characters that he creates or reinvents or writes for. And I feel like Watchmen is one of those books that really is invested in a certain level of kind of boots on the ground practicality.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Moore himself was saying something to the effect of, just because you have superheroes in the world doesn't mean that everybody's flying around, you know, like standing around with their hands on their hips and their legs a mile apart. And he did take the idea of the impractical concepts and make them as practical as possible, to the point where, you know, we're going back to that Batman factor where Night Owl has that sort of practicality of maintaining a workshop.
Right, right. Well, he had retired, hadn't he, at that point? So he needed some scratch coming in from somewhere. How do these guys practically fund what they're doing if you're not Iron Man or Batman?
And we've touched on that before, that the practical offshoot of superheroing is either you're a hero for hire, which is dead center on the scale, or what is wonderful about Watchmen is you have both ends of the only scale that work. And that is, you have to be Batman rich, or, for lack of another analog, Rorschach poor. You have to be Ozymandias rich or Rorschach poor. Those are the two guys who have nothing but time on their hands.
Right. Right, you have nothing when you're Rorschach poor. You have nothing to lose by becoming a superhero. When you're Batman rich, you have enough to lose by becoming a superhero. So there's no real, you know, there's no real middle class superheroes, unless you look at characters like Animal Man, or, you know, guys who have a family. The ones that are writers, those are my favorites, just because it lends itself so well to superheroing. Like, freelance writers, reporters, of course there are 1,000 reporters. The impracticality of Spider-Man knows no bounds. The impracticality of the character itself knows no bounds. Couple that with the stories that they've written him into, and you just have a Petrushka doll of just ridiculous concepts all smashed together that somehow work because we allow them to.
Yeah, exactly. But kind of like thinking through the really impractical, and I love, you and I had a discussion before the show about a little over under a week ago about how you were having a hard time finding anything impractical in comics, because by their very nature, everything's impractical. Ergo, you know, how can you know, at what point is anything impractical when everything's impractical?
Right.
And a lot of it comes down to things like just ridiculous vehicles.
Yes.
You know, that they look great, but try taking a corner on Judge Dredd's motorcycle.
Right. Because physics obviously don't work the way that they do, you know, in the real world, somehow in comic books. Because your Batmobiles don't look like cars that should ever work. Ever.
Yes, exactly.
You know, they're if you look at the Batmobile, like the Batmobile from like the animated Batman series on up through, you know, even in the comic books, they're like 35 feet long, an inch off the ground, with a jet engine strapped to the back. Like, this shouldn't work. The helicarrier shouldn't work. It defies.
The helicarrier is one of those over the top. Just ridiculous notions in the same way, like the raft as a prison. You know, somebody, it's like, we got more money than sense. Let's build this. For one thing, no one would sit for that.
Right, right.
You know, every single helicarrier costs $14 trillion just to turn the key in the engine.
Right.
I'm not talking about building the thing. I don't even want to know what it costs. I can't think in figures of that monumental, astronomical, exponential scale.
Right. Let alone the fact that you've got to keep this thing constantly in the air. Constantly. There's no, you know, it doesn't, I imagine at some point it comes down for maintenance, you know, but you pretty much, if that is your base of operations for S.H.I.E.L.D., it's in the air all the time.
Yeah.
What's the cost of keeping that thing just in the air all the time?
Well, the thing about it is, for practicality's sake, much like our submarine fleet, it's a nuclear oh, that's a bad idea.
Yeah, not good.
Wow.
Not good.
That is, yeah. That's right up there with a giant flying sunshades for soccer game, soccer tournaments in Oman. Which is a genuine thing, by the
yes.
way, that's being floated or flown.
No pun intended.
Yeah, just bad idea. It's like, you know, Amazon proudly saying their first drone order took like 16 minutes to achieve. And I guarantee you, they start delivering in some parts of the country, it'll take 16 seconds for the thing to be shot down. And somebody's got a new blender with a hole in it.
Somebody's scope needs calibrated, but
wow, this is the best, Paul. It's Tom Clancy's new book with a grape shot in it. I don't know why they're using grape shot. No one has used that since about 1810, but
that's better than the mental image, the visual image I had of them flying over some areas of the country, which my, you know, my lineage comes from, where it would probably be like Ebola, like somebody with like two rocks and a string tied together, like whipping it over their head and throwing it at the thing, which would probably are like a butterfly net and a hill would be what some of my family would be invested in. That's awesome. That is great.
But, you know, talking about like the Martian Manhunter earlier brought up the point that, you know, he's got that kind of Superman thing where he's, you know, he can turn invisible, shapeshift, read your mind. He can, not only can he like shapeshift to look like other guys and gals, he can stretch like Mr. Fantastic. And he's got this whole, you know, he can go invisible. And if I mention that, he just likes going invisible, if I mention that twice. all of this stuff, but yet he's if you know, like if you were to hit him with a great big stick, he would not even so much as register that as a sensation.
Right.
But if you were to hit him with a tiki torch, he would freak the hell out.
Lose his Martian mind. Absolutely.
I mean, you could go hit him with a damn girder from a cartoon construction site. And he will so baby Huey that in the shape of his head. But boy, you come at him with a lit book of matches like some creep in a noir movie. You just watch him wet those shorts.
His trunks. Watch him wet them trunks up. No, you're right. That is an interesting.
It's like you have to have these conceits, but the conceits themselves are wildly impractical. Why yellow for the Green Lantern or wood for the original Green Lantern?
Right. Why fire for the Martian Manhunter? Why kryptonite? Why an invented conceit for Superman? Though he does have his anti-affinity for magic, which magic is a whole other can of impractical worms if you want to open that
brittle. If anything, Marvel Cinematic Universe has taught us, magic creates its own problems when it comes to, how do you reconcile magic?
Right.
In the practical world. And that's why Watchmen has no magicians. No, their only mystic is just a hack. He's just a party. He's like Kmar the discount magician turned to crime.
No, you're...
Now, there is a deep cut right there.
That was almost as deep as T-Bowing, maybe a little more deep than T-Bowing.
No, I think it is like a few years deeper than T-Bowing.
No, but so can we talk for a second? There's a character that's been in my head, in my zeitgeist for about the past 4 weeks, and I've been really thinking about this character, and it hadn't occurred to me whether this character was practical or impractical, and at what to what degree until I was just thinking about it, and I would like to know your feelings on this perennial Hey Kids Comics favorite, and possibly the greatest villain in comic book history, J. Jonah Jameson. I would like to know. Yeah, I'm challenging you to quantify his practicality, because I feel like he's probably a pretty impractical guy in one of the most practical positions in all.
I'm afraid I'm actually going to have to be counterintuitive here, because I was prepared to agree with you on the impracticality level until such time as it occurred to me that, much like a sketch on many, many years ago on SCTV, where they had like a National Enquirer TV series, like a daily or
yeah
show that literally predates like tabloid television,
TMZ and all that.
Yeah, no, I can't remember that show that was just incessant all the time.
Access Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight.
Or even before that, it was like Extra or something like
Extra
that.
Extra was bad, yeah.
Or there was one that was just inflammatory, bad tabloid television, and they literally, by virtue of the sketch, predicted that. And I think in many ways, J. Jonah Jameson, with his obsession over Spider-Man and his somehow being able to maintain an attractive circulation on his paper without being like some sort of Depression-era gangster type. You want to put our paper out on your shelf there. We're like rack jobbers.
Oh, it's Angela
sell
coming
a paper.
Back?
Well, yeah, you come in and you take out the old ones. You take our paper. We put you on the rack, and that's our job. So we're rack jobbers.
I thought Angela was going to make a return appearance to the show for a second there.
This is the kind of things Angela got to live down.
Not for nothing. I'm just saying.
That's the kind of guy that gave Angela's family a bad name. But he's literally the way that Jameson can have this sort of Spider-Man tirade and spend newspaper funds to try to kill Spider-Man, no less.
Right.
Attempted murder and conspiracy are certainly actionable actions.
They're crimes. They are crimes.
You want the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy to tell him, no, that's a terrible crime.
No, you're a criminal. You are a criminal.
You're trying to kill a person. That's wrong. But I really hate him. It's still wrong.
I get that. But
it actually, they successfully, through the conduit of that character, predicted Fox News.
Granted, but I mean, that's absolutely...
It's hard to find impracticality when someone has already given us a real-world model that is phenomenally successful against
all
logic.
It's true. It doesn't matter how illogical it is. If it's actually happening, it has to be practical.
God forbid my own father ever listens to the show. I love you, Dad, but, you know, lay off the Fox News.
No, but like I was, because my thinking on J. Jonah, a friend of our show is thinking about starting his own podcast where he breaks down fiduciarily criminals or super criminals, not necessarily just in comics, but across the spectrum of media, and in the terms of how much you would have to pay, how much output there would be, how much cost there would be. And we were discussing J. Jonah Jameson, and I was just thinking about just... Is it practical to start a one-man lynch mob, a one-man, posse comitatus against this one guy using all of the funds from your newspaper to hire assassins or put out, literal hit pieces on this guy? But I guess you're right. There is a real-world application for that idea. I can't argue that. You are correct.
Well, especially when the very blatant attempt, where the FBI uncovered the Fox's Obama Slayer. I think at that point I'm like, good night, I didn't make the connection until then.
I really did open all the windows and the doors like it's the first nice spring day for that joke, didn't I? I just went through the house.
And it flew right in, just like a bat in your reading parlor.
Damn it. Now I want to put on a costume. Why is my voice like this all of a sudden? I can't stop it.
It's because the window open.
So the one thing,
I should like some tea.
As we creep up close to closing time on this issue of Hey Kids Comics.
Well, there's so much impracticality.
I know. I did want to talk about this, though. The supposed, like we're convinced, we're being made to be convinced that our street-level characters are the closest to practicality that we can get, right? Punishers, Moon Knights, we'll go with Moon Knights, your Green Arrows, your Batmans, they're as close to you. And as far away from Superman or, Supreme or, any of these guys as you can get. But I think in a lot of ways, these street-level characters are the most impractical characters that there are.
Absolutely, because so many of them, like Spider-Man and Daredevil, rely very heavily on the structural integrity of the entire city of New York.
Right. You're absolutely correct.
God forbid anything is in disrepair if your billy club or your webbing happens to catch it. there are a lot of buildings in New York City where the fire escapes are little more than set dressing. Unless you're of incredibly slight build, chances are you're better off just, crawling to below the smoke line down the stairs.
Right. And we all know that,
inside the building, a small child and a squirrel on there, the thing's going to give.
and you know as well as I do that just
it's
like
rust.
Every city, the zoning commission isn't great. They aren't keeping everything. The infrastructure sucks. Like, I'm surprised the bridge held up long enough for Green Goblin to drop Gwen Stacy off of it.
I know.
But the one that really comes to mind.
Nothing else, just mind the bridge needed work.
That's true. Well, we got to look at that bridge.
Young woman, but the bridge.
We got to take a good look at that bridge. But the one that always.
That should be symbolic for them.
So I want to take a good hard look at the Punisher for a second in terms of practicality.
Okay. Now we're hitting a level of impracticality that.
Right. As we come to a close, let's talk about the Punisher for a second. Let's talk about this vigilante who has probably committed the longest, bloodiest mass murder spree in the history of New York, travels by unmarked white van that is literally full of guns and ammunition. I'm surprised you have enough room
sagging on its wheel wells under the weight of all that ordnance.
Right. I'm surprised you have room for a tire jack and a AAA map back there. Just full of, you know, large ordnance. And yet, still manages to get away with it. How does that work? Where is the practicality there, Cole? Help me. Help me help myself.
Especially in a world where you have, you know, super beings tripping over each other to rescue cats
right.
on a slow day.
Right.
And meanwhile, over on, you know, the Saul's secret bar for mob bosses.
3 stars on Yelp.
Yeah, that's right. It is, you know, instantaneously turned into a theater of war, and nobody seems to just be, like, happen to be dropping by. It's like, well, you know, we were going to help, but two things, bad guys and Blastar showed up.
Blastar, the Kree came back. What are we going to do?
You tell me. Are you going to go, you know, if you're sitting there and, you know, at the bar and you're kind of flirting with the frumpy girl that could be hot if she wanted to be? And then, you know, all of a sudden you're getting flirted. You're the one, you know, the hot chick's buying you drinks, and you're pretty sure you're not getting crime gamed. Then chances are you're going to go home
God
with her.
God damn it. You're not.
And that's why
verb.
The frumpy girl goes home with Frank Castle.
The verb. You just made the movie The Crying Game into a verb.
I did. Because as I learned on Saturday morning television, that's what's happening.
That's what's going down. You got to be careful. But yeah, that always struck me as odd was you're in New York City, home of the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, Heroes for Hire, any number of Spider-Man, any number of just disparate superheroes.
Oh, yeah. And then there's always the hangers-on and the drive-throughs and the visiting luminaries and what have you.
Right. I only imagine the average day in the life of a superhero in New York is like the average day for Jerry Seinfeld in the Seinfeld show. They all get together at Monk's. They argue over the big salad. Kramer shows up. He leaves the door unlocked. They get robbed. Putty shows up. He's got a fur coat on. Like, and in the background the whole time.
And Forbush Man is like Newman.
Right. And in the meantime, Frank Castle's driving around in an unmarked white van full of M16s, like a New Year's Eve party popper, just waiting to go off, just offing people in Central Park, and nobody's like, hey, listen, all right, we should probably do something about this. Like, just let's step in, let's do something. No, it's fine. The cops can't find them. The superheroes can't find them. It always struck me as really crazy.
Well,
at what
point does Frank Castle sober up enough that he just puts one of his myriad pistols in his mouth because he's just as bad as the underworld he's been fighting?
Right. Or at what point does he say, okay, I'm going to go to Nick Fury, and I'm going to say, Nick, how's about you give me a job where I'm doing basically the same thing I'm doing now, only I'm doing it under the auspices of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like,
does S.H.I.E.L.D. have a wet works department?
I mean, Black Widow. Like, who could out Black Widow Black Widow? Oh, wait, the crazy, you know.
Yeah, probably would get to the point where Natasha would show up somewhere and, like, all of her targets would already be down. He's like, okay, guys, I thought there was, you know, a certain exclusivity here. And they're like, hey, none of ours, we have no boots on the ground there.
Right.
You're it.
Just Frank Castle's been everywhere.
Like, picks up this fistful, you know, she's practically falling on her ass on the, just the litter of brass casings everywhere.
The spent shells.
Yeah, she's like, picks this thing up, and it's still warm. Castle.
It's like Joe Pesci at Home Alone in there. All right, Cole, we've hit an hour.
Okay, well, since we have hit the hour without just, like, touching on every single impractical character, my hope is that this has at least kind of got people thinking about all these characters that they've laughed at over the years. The Stilt Mans and the, you know, like, for example, Stiltman is probably the poster child for the Impracticals, because his particular, I mean, there are so many armors that they had to have wars over them.
Yes, yes.
And the most impractical among them all, hands down, is, or feet down for that matter, is Stiltman. Because apart from reproducing, you know, unless you're trying to imitate Bluto in Animal House, you really don't, there's not a lot of things you can do with the stilt legs that would ever be useful.
Right.
But somebody, but DC tried to one-up that with a character, I kid you not, called Tapeworm.
Yes, yes.
Which was the same idea, but instead of, like, having, like, stilt leg jammies, you had a stilt leg sleeping bag. This guy is like the high-tech potato sack race. It's 14 yards long. There are members of the Serpent Society who felt vindicated, you know, from all the ridicule they took.
Yes, yes, and that
the headman felt better when that character came along.
That also reminds me, as we're closing, of there are certain groups and characters in the comics that have realized, you know, in a very meta kind of way, that they're going to embrace their impracticality. They're giving a middle finger to practicality. They're like, we're impractical, what of it? And I think none of them do it in a more smart kind of way than and I'm not talking about like the Great Lakes Avengers, not in a comedic way, but in a well written kind of way than the Doom Patrol.
Yes, they did sort of escape their origins and then become something bizarre, and then I think I've sort of softened around the edges and become something skirting the two incarnations.
Yeah, they did, and you know, for something that began as sort of DC's kind of take on the X-Men, which is what the Doom Patrol kind of was, you know, you had Niles Calder, who was the head of the Doom Patrol, you know, being a wheelchair-bound mega genius.
Oh, yeah, and it was painfully obvious when Robot Man said, what do they call you, Wheels?
Right, but you had Robot Man, who was a man who was a robot with a man's brain, you know, not cyborg style, like 1950s sci-fi, you know, be real movie robot with a man's brain. You had the Negative Man, who would, like, leave his body and fly around in negative. You had, what was her name? I can't remember her name. The one that became
Elastigirl.
Yes, you had Elastigirl. You know, you had Metamorpho. Speaking of impracticality, you had Metamorpho involved in that group. You had Beast Boy at some points involved in that group. They just took the most impractical characters, put them together, and said, go be impractical.
Yeah.
Go be yourself. You be you, Doom Patrol.
Don't be
it.
Impractical. The stories will come.
The stories will write themselves. Oh, my God. All right. Well, let's get out of here. I think we've impractically closed this show. No more so impractically than any other show we've done, though.
Yeah, I think the really impractical thing is we keep butting up against that damned hour. Just,
I know. We've got to keep
just
it.
Go.
We got to keep it on lockdown. We got
absolutely.
We got to regulate ourselves somehow. Otherwise, we'd be here tonight.
I do want to challenge people. If you would please write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. If you can think of impractical characters, we're going to try to, like, you know, mention some fan favorites.
Yes.
Impracticals on future episodes, and we're going to get practical or get gushingly into something that we practically can't get enough of, and that is, we're going back to the toy aisle.
Oh, so good.
Which we love to do every chance we get, for literally a show called Isle of Toys.
So good, so good. I can't
which,
wait.
Which has that little sort of alliteration there as well. But this is going to be the precursor to a future JCU show, and this is I'm actually working on producing a brand new monthly called Isle of Toys, with its wonderful double meaning, where it'll be myself talking to other people about all genre of different toys, even some I'm not terribly familiar with myself. So I'm very much looking forward to that. This is kind of the precursor to that. We're going to go heavily into comic stuff. because there's some amazing stuff that's like out right now or things from the past that we haven't talked about before. And you know us and toys.
Can't get enough. I can't stop talking. I can't stop looking at them. Actually, today, as a preview, today I got the Marvel Legends Sam Wilson, Captain America, Vision, and Kate Bishop Hawkeye 3-pack of Marvel Legends. This was a great year for action figure collection as far as Amazon and Walmart and all those go, and we'll talk about it. And I think that next year we're going to plan well in advance to do maybe a crossover with the upcoming show, but at least on Hey Kids Comics, to talk to people about how and where and when to buy toys for Christmas and where to get the best deals, because I think a lot of people missed some boats on that topic, and I know I did. I know I missed a lot of really good deals this year on action figures, and I kind of am kicking myself in the ass for it. So I want to touch on that too.
Absolutely. So we're looking forward to that coming up next week. And, of course, we're coming to you from the Jedi Cold Universe at JediCold.com or through Cinelinks at Cinelinks.com. We are now powered by Cinelinks.
Yep.
And I can feel it already. And, of course, look for myself and Eddie Medina from the Rancor Pit on the Rancor Pit Live on WatchOnAirLive.com, the first and third Sundays of every month from noon to 1 p.m. Central, except the very first Sunday of January, because that's too much abutting the new year and we decided we'd be too exhausted to care.
There you go.
So we'll be back in full swing in 2017. The JCU is coming back full force with a lot of great new shows coming your way.
That's right. And we're coming back from our hiatus stronger than ever. A lot of new content, a lot of new shows, story arcs coming up. We realize we haven't done a good story arc in a while, so we got a couple of those coming. And you know, we around this time of year, we tend to get a little gushy, a little moist, a little squishy on the inside. But we do want to thank everybody that's out there that listens every week, especially you, Clay, that, you know, that, you know, we wouldn't do this without you guys. It's a hell of a lot of fun. It's worthwhile work, and we enjoy every second of it, and we hope you guys too. Don't be strangers. Let us know what you're thinking. Like Cole was saying earlier, jcumail@yahoo.com. Let us know what you're thinking. Let us know what's going on. Visit the new improved website. Check it out. There's a lot of great stuff there. We love you guys. Thank you for being patrons and allowing us to do something we love every week. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And just it is always a joy to be here and talk about comics and weird things and just have fun.
That's right. So join us next week when we really get into some toys, which is something we absolutely love doing. We hope that you had a great hot Christmas holiday and that you're going to have a safe and ridiculous new year. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.